5:55 was Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting a series of bomb blasts killed nearly 150 people in two normally quiet Syrian coastal cities Monday. The blasts involving car bombs and suicide attackers claimed by Islamic State occurred in the government strongholds of Jabla and Tartus. The militant group said the targets were members of President Bashar al-Assad's Alawite minority. Russia, which backs Mr. Assad, has a naval base in Tartus and an air base north of Jabla. A Kremlin spokesman said the attacks underscore the need to continue the negotiation process. The U.S. also condemned the attacks by the IS group, also known as Daesh. Mark Toner, a U.S. spokesman.
We're obviously going to continue efforts to destroy Daesh in the region. We understand that Daesh represents a threat that is palpable to all in Syria and in Iraq. I think what it highlights is the need, urgent need, to get a political process moving forward that can resolve the civil war in Syria so that all parties can turn their attention to Daesh.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon also condemned the attacks and noted an escalation of military activity in the country. IS terrorists Monday also claimed responsibility for a pair of suicide bombings outside an army recruitment center in Yemen's southern city of Aden and outside the Badr army base that killed more than 40 people. More protests against Kenya's Electoral Commission took place in several cities of Kenya Monday. In Nairobi, riot police used tear gas and water cannon to disperse some 100 demonstrators before they could get close to commission headquarters. Other protests against electoral bias occurred in Kisumu, where reports say one person was killed, Mombasa, and Kakamega. This is VOA News. Iraqi forces say they've retaken agricultural areas around the town of Garma outside Fallujah, the western Iraqi city held by Islamic State. Sunday, Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi announced a combined ground offensive has begun to retake the city. There are hundreds of IS militant fighters in Fallujah, the offensive expected to take weeks. President Obama will deliver a speech in Hanoi Tuesday, expected to focus on improved relations between the U.S. and Vietnam. He mentioned the importance of good ties with Hanoi and the Asia-Pacific region during a joint news conference with his Vietnamese counterpart, Tran Dai Quang, Monday.
Vietnam is a large, vital, growing country in a large, vital, and growing region of the world. It is a young and dynamic region. It is full of entrepreneurial spirit, and you're seeing new companies and new jobs being created constantly. So the United States wants to be a part of that.
White House officials said the president Tuesday will emphasize the importance of the two nations engaging in meaningful talks when they disagree, including on human rights. Mr. Obama will also meet Tuesday with civil society activists as well as young entrepreneurs. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has issued a call for better international cooperation in sharing the burden of addressing the world's largest humanitarian crisis.
Birleşmiş Milletler verilerine göre dünyada en çok
Mr. Erdogan spoke Monday in Istanbul during a two-day UN summit that convened against the backdrop of a massive migration into Turkey of Syrian and Iraqi civilians fleeing years of conflict. Analysts say the presence of some 3 million migrants on Turkish soil makes the country the world's largest host of displaced people, part of what the UN calls the worst humanitarian crisis since World War II. South Korea Tuesday said an unspecified number of North Korean workers have fled their jobs in Shanghai, China, and will seek asylum in South Korea. Media reports say two or three North Koreans fled to an unidentified Southeast Asian nation early this month. Last month, a group of 13 North Koreans who worked at a North Korean-run restaurant in eastern China defected to the South. Philippines' presumptive president-elect Rodrigo Duterte Monday said he will allow the burial of the late dictator Ferdinand Marcos at the Philippines Heroes Cemetery despite opposition. Marcos fled to Hawaii in 1986 following a popular uprising that ended his 20-year rule. He died in exile in 1989. South African authorities detained three Chinese vessels and dozens of crew members for allegedly illegal fishing in Indian ocean waters off Port Elizabeth. Inspectors found hundreds of tons of squid on board. South Africa has a 200 nautical mile economic exclusion zone without permits. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 24th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. At least three people died Monday in anti-election commission protest in Kenya.
With IEBC, we see the elections will not be credible. The results will be doctored and all that. Yes, they'll favor the current government.
Rufus Mangaga is a supporter of Kenya's opposition court coalition. Liberia's Special Corruption Task Force begins executing probable cause arrests. A nationwide fuel shortage hits South Sudan's main hospital, and the UN Humanitarian Summit in Istanbul, Turkey, enters its second day today, Tuesday.
Today we declare we are one humanity with the shared responsibilities. Let us resolve ourselves here and now. Not only to keep people alive, but to give people a chance at life in dignity.
That's UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. ZANU-PF youth plan a millionaire march tomorrow Wednesday in solidarity with 92-year-old President Robert Mugabe. And the WHO says the world is unprepared to cope with emerging infectious diseases. Those stories plus Marco Uman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Protests against Kenya's Electoral Commission took place in three cities on Monday, with local media reporting that at least three demonstrators were killed in Western Kenya. VOA's Jill Craig has more from Nairobi.
Riot police formed a line around Kenya's Electoral Commission headquarters Monday, waiting much of the afternoon armed with tear gas, water cannons, and tanks to deter demonstrators arriving for the now weekly protests against the commission. The protesters never reached the compound because police used tear gas and water cannons to disperse about 100 demonstrators before they could get close. Protesters were able to march against offices of the Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission, or IEBC, in the cities of Mombasa, Kakamega, and Kisumu. A reporter for the Standard newspaper, Philip Orwa, told VOA that one demonstrator in Kisumu was killed and four others hospitalized. There were conflicting reports on whether the deceased protester was shot or trampled to death. Local media also reported two fatalities in Siaya, a town northwest of Kisumu. Asa Inyakundi is a lawyer whose office is located near the Electoral Commission headquarters in Nairobi.
Today it wasn't as intense as it was before. I think what the police seem to have done, they were under instructions not to let people gather in big groups or in any groups at all. So I think in that sense, they were able to thwart any big groups and therefore the capacity to demonstrate.
Many bystanders agreed that the police acted more professionally this week than last, when photos and videos of riot police clubbing and kicking protesters were shared widely on social media and sparked outrage. The protesters, most of whom are supporters of the opposition court coalition, say the IEBC must be disbanded ahead of next year's national elections. The opposition says the IEBC favors the ruling Jubilee coalition. The opposition has held protests on four of the past five Mondays and has vowed to continue until the government engages in meaningful dialogue about the electoral process. Rufus Magaga is a court supporter and demonstrator.
With IEBC, we see the elections will not be credible. The results will be doctored and all that. Yes, they'll favor the current government.
But Inyakundi warns that these protests do not represent the opinions of the entire electorate.
I believe that what you're seeing now is just partisan politics. There is a whole group of Kenyans who do not agree with this.
Kenya is scheduled to hold presidential and parliamentary elections in August 2017. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
World leaders are convening in Istanbul with official optimism, upset by concerns that summit may prove to be a photo opportunity rather than a catalyst for change. Doreen Jones reports from Istanbul.
An opportunity to shape history is how United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon described the UN's first humanitarian summit. With over 100 million refugees worldwide, levels not seen since the end of World War II, the Secretary General said the gathering was aimed at getting the world to change its attitudes and mentality.
Today we declare we are one humanity with the shared responsibilities. Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, let us resolve ourselves here and now not only to keep people alive, but to give people a chance at life in dignity.
The UN Secretary General is calling on countries to provide more money and to share the refugee burden more equally. That call was echoed by the summit host, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan.
Bunu tecrübe eden ülke Türkiye'dir. Ülkemizdeki sığınma...
Erdogan urged all countries to shoulder responsibility for the refugees. Turkey says it has spent more than $10 billion on migrants, while the international community's contributions remain at $455 million. The summit was mired in controversy even before the two-day conference started. French-based Doctors Without Borders called it a fig leaf for international failures, and Oxfam dismissed it as an expensive talking shop. Few leading heads of state from donor countries are attending. German Chancellor Angela Merkel is the highest-profile Western leader at the two-day conference. That, observers say, is bad news for the UN, which is hoping to secure pledges to cover a projected shortfall in billions of dollars needed by its agencies to deal with the refugee crisis. The European Union committed itself to what it called a grand bargain to help the UN close the shortfall. Part of the deal entails redirecting finances to those on the front line of assisting agencies. Along with funding, the Secretary General urged nations to uphold and enforce international laws, particularly regarding the protection of schools and hospitals, which have been repeatedly targeted in conflict zones. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
In Liberia, a special presidential task force appointed by President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf to investigate the corruption report released last month by Global Witness on Monday began enforcing what it calls probable cause arrests. The London-based Global Witness alleged that close to $1 million in bribes and other suspicious payments were made to top Liberian officials by the Britain-based Sable Mining Company and its Liberian lawyer, Vonnie Sherman. Task Force Chairman and Minister of State Without Portfolio, Councillor J. Fonati Kofa, says bribery under Liberian law is a criminal offense. But he said the probable cause arrest was not targeting Councillor Sherman alone, but all those who have been named in the Global Witness report.
The multi-agency presidential task force on the Global Witness report started off this morning to effectuate a series of probable cause arrests. The primary agents in charge of that portion of the operations were the agents from the Liberian Anti-Corruption Commission. I think at some point, some individuals went to the residence of the counselor, and that brought in, of course, based on disruptive behavior, brought in the police to try to maintain order, but it was not a question of surrounding the counselor's house.
So, Councillor, you said probable cause arrest. Were the agents of the Anti-Corruption Commission going to arrest Councillor Sherman?
Let's remember one thing. This is not about Councillor Sherman. This is about the Global Witness report. And what the agents did was, if they have probable cause to believe a crime has been committed and an individual committed that crime, they can go and hold that individual for about 48 hours under our law. They did not attempt to do that only for Councillor Sherman. There were a number of persons who were targeted this morning.
Did you get a warrant to execute this probable cause arrest?
Well, probable cause arrest is not based on warrants. What we did have, the Ministry of Justice also subsequently, within 2 hours, also had a search warrant for the premises of Councillor Sherman and the law offices of Councillor Sherman. They are in the process of executing a search warrant on the law office. They have not yet done the premises.
This is not an assumption that this Global Witness report, is that what your commission believe, that a criminal offense might have taken place?
Yes, the report alleges bribery. Bribery under our law is a criminal offense.
I've read somewhere where Councillor Sherman has said that he is not going to submit himself to your commission. Is that true? And has he informed you?
He has informed us that he does not intend to cooperate, yes.
So what happens if he does not cooperate? You cannot break into his house, can you?
No, we can't break into his house unless we get a warrant to arrest him. We are contemplating other issues. This is not the only step along the way. There are going to be a series of steps. We have to make sure we always conform legally and under the rule of law. And again, this is not about Councillor Sherman. They're about persons who were named in that report.
Does this include the current Speaker of the Liberian House of Representatives? Because he's also mentioned in the Global Witness report.
I will refer you to the report. This is about investigation of persons who were named in that report.
Councillor Sherman is chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and they said that perhaps this is a vendetta against him because he at one time expressed to the president that he wasn't going to approve your nomination to be justice minister. Are you aware of that?
I'm not aware. I didn't write the Global Witness report. I didn't engineer the Global Witness report. The Global Witness report came to us, and I was assigned that responsibility as a result of grave damage to the country's image. The only way your theory or the assumption of someone can be true is if indeed they can show that I participated in engineering the report from Global Witness. I had no clue about that. And I absolutely and categorically deny that this is about any vendetta.
Councillor J. Fonati Kofa is the chairman of the Special Task Force to investigate the Global Witness corruption allegations. He was speaking with me from Liberia's capital, Monrovia. VOA contacted Councillor Vani Sherman, but he said he had no comment. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 24th. Let's give a shout-out to listeners on these, our VOA affiliate stations, Radio Banga FM 96.5 in Bong County, Central Liberia, Radio Live in Lofa County, Liberia, and Buffalo FM in Monrovia, Liberia. Daybreak Africa time is now 17 minutes past the hour. The main hospital in South Sudan's capital, Juba, can no longer run its generators due to a severe nationwide fuel shortage. The last time this happened in January, 10 patients died because staff could not perform necessary procedures. Jason Pantinkin reports from Juba.
Operations have ground to a halt at South Sudan's largest hospital thanks to a week-long power outage owing to a massive fuel shortage in the capital city. One doctor at Juba Teaching Hospital, speaking anonymously for fear of reprisals from his bosses, said doctors can no longer perform most emergency operations.
The generator doesn't have fuel, and so by then we don't have a power for us to run, especially the very important departments such as the general surgery and Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology, which are very vital. They need power actually in terms of operations.
The doctor said he tells patients to either buy fuel to run the hospital's generators for the duration of the surgery or to pay for a private clinic elsewhere. But this hospital serves the city's poorest residents. Most cannot afford it.
Even me, they have been calling me now that we need operation, but I told them frankly, there's nothing I can do, nothing in my hand.
A woman in labor writhes in pain in the maternity ward. She has suffered epileptic seizures. Her mother-in-law, Jennifer Joseph, is looking frantically for one jerry can, about 20 liters, worth of fuel so Helen can have an emergency C-section.
They say that if the fuel is now ready, they will just make the operation now.
But even if she finds the fuel, she doesn't know how she will pay for it.
What can I say? I will just put God ahead because I have no money.
One jerry can of fuel costs about 500 South Sudanese pounds, or about $12. The lines at the pumps can last all day. Black market fuel is simply out of reach. 2.5 years of civil war have wrecked the economy. South Sudan is actually an oil-producing country, but it doesn't have refineries, so the government subsidizes imported fuel. Many citizens in Juba demand the new transitional unity government fix the fuel crisis. The doctor said the hospital has mostly stopped working at night. There is simply no one to receive gunshot or accident victims. In the nearly empty surgical ward, a man lies in a bed, his abdomen dangerously distended, 2 weeks after having his appendix removed. His brother, Michael Chiang Bol, said the family doesn't have any money to buy the 3 jerry cans of fuel needed for another surgery.
It is a transitional government of national unity to put the efforts to look into the problem of this hospital. It's the one who could really bring the fuel so that the people of South Sudan could get the right treatment within the hospital.
The Minister of Petroleum was unavailable to comment. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Juba.
ZANU-PF youth say they are going ahead with a planned Million Men March tomorrow, Africa Day, to show solidarity with 92-year-old President Robert Mugabe. The march is said to be the brainchild of one of the factions of ZANU-PF, allegedly led by First Lady Grace Mugabe. Gibbs Dube of VOA Zimbabwe Service talked with Tongai Kasukuwere and MDCT youth leader Lovemore Chanupusa. First, Kasukuwere says the Million Man March will benefit Zimbabweans in many ways.
We are appreciating the leadership and the vision of His Excellency, who has led the country to the next level of independence through overseeing the revolutionary redistribution of the basic means of production. So the ZANU-PF Youth League is basically saying that legacy has got to be celebrated. That legacy has got to be something that we need each and every young person here in Zimbabwe to look up to. And also, the ZANU-PF Youth League is not blind to the realities of what is happening in the country. We are saying we need to mobilize for the economic empowerment of young people by bringing to account our own government and also to implementing the vision that the president has called for, an empowered society and a growing economy. We are not people to go to press conferences and be shouting at our own government. No, we've got an opportunity to meet with our leadership. We've got an opportunity to celebrate our leadership. And through that opportunity which is given to us, we can also articulate some of the challenges the people the young people of Zimbabwe are facing in a much more civilized manner, not to stand on top of a roof and, be doing megaphone diplomacy. That's not the way we operate.
Let's bring in Mr. Chinobuza. Hey, briefly, what is your reaction to what Mr. Kasukuwere is saying?
Basically, our reaction is that there is more that could be done by the Youth League of ZANU-PF. The issue here is not about over-celebrating a man who has failed the people of this country. The issue here is not about lying to this man that they didn't want him to continue, because we know that at this point in time, ZANU-PF is disintegrating in each and every faction that came to him to take over power. So we will not be cowed into submission by a faction in ZANU-PF, the so-called G40, that wants to show its support to Robert Mugabe, when in fact we know that it is only positioning itself to take over power. Our main worry is, after people have shown their so-called support to Mugabe, is the situation of the young person on the ground going to improve? Is the situation of the young person who is failing to get a job going to improve? Are the people who are not going to get a meal simply because the ZANU-PF Youth League has taken to the streets to celebrate the men who have brought so much challenges in this country?
What Chinobuza is saying here is that, kindly tell the president that his time is up and, are you going to do that?
No, my friend. You see, look, Chinobuza is a confused young man. He's coming from a party with seven different factions in itself, and he wants to come and call the ruling party of this country a factional party. We have one ZANU-PF, we have one president, and that is Comrade Arajit Mugabe, and he is in charge as we speak today. So stop talking about factions in ZANU-PF. You need to concentrate on MDC, which has seven different ones. First of all, fix your own house before you start talking about that.
That was MDCT youth leader Lovemore Chanupusa and ZANU-PF Youth League member Tongai Kasukuwere. Both spoke with Gibbs Dube of VOA Zimbabwe program. The Director General of the World Health Organization, Margaret Chan, warns that the world is not ready to cope with the threats posed by emerging and re-emerging infectious diseases. Chan told some 3,500 delegates attending the annual World Health Assembly they must work together to overcome global health threats. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
World Health Organization Chief Margaret Chan told this gathering of health ministers and providers that countries could no longer work in isolation to contain infectious diseases and overcome other health threats. She says few threats are local anymore. She says people and goods move around in this interconnected world, and so do diseases. For example, she notes, drug-resistant pathogens, including the growing number of superbugs, travel internationally in people, animals, and food.
The Ebola outbreak in three small countries paralyzed the world with fear and travel constraints. The rapidly evolving outbreak of Zika virus, warns us that an old disease that slumber for six decades in Africa and Asia can suddenly wake up on a new continent to cause a global health emergency.
The Zika virus is particularly dangerous to pregnant women as it is linked with brain abnormalities in newborn babies. Chan says outbreaks become emergencies when affected countries have weak health systems that are unprepared to deal with them. In the case of Ebola, she says, the epidemic spiraled out of control in large part because the West African countries lacked the means to detect, diagnose, and properly care for the patients.
For Zika, we are again taken by surprise with no vaccines and no reliable and widely available diagnostic tests. To protect women of childbearing age, what can we do? We can only offer advice. Avoid mosquito bites, delay pregnancy, do not travel to areas with ongoing transmission.
Chan says WHO's health emergency management system is undergoing a major reform to ensure its teams are able to respond more quickly and effectively to outbreaks and humanitarian emergencies. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Marco Uma in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak African Sports News, we begin with football. FIFA Deputy Secretary General Markus Kärntner is dismissed from office with immediate effect, FIFA disclosed in Zurich, Switzerland on Monday. According to FIFA, Kärntner, who is Swiss-German, has breached FIFA financial ethical practices involving millions of US dollars. FIFA confirms Swiss prosecutors are investigating Kärntner. In Egypt, the draws for the group stage in the Orange Africa Championship League and Orange Africa Confederations Cup take place in Cairo today, Tuesday. The eight still in contention for this year's Champions League are Egypt's El Ahly and Zamalek, the Democratic Republic of Congo's AS Vita, Ivory Coast's ASEC Mimosa, Algeria's Entente Setif, Nigeria's Enyimba, Morocco's Wydad AC, and Zambia's Zesco United. Those in the draws for the Confederations Cup are Tunisian defending champions Etoile du Sahel, Libya's El Ahly Tripoli, Algeria's Mouloudia Bejaia, Ghana's Mediama, Morocco's FUS Rabat and Kaukab Marrakech, the Democratic Republic of Congo's TP Mazembe, and Tanzania's Young Africans. Turning to athletics, Ethiopia's Dejan Gebremeskel clocked 13 minutes and 0.99 seconds to triumph in 5,000 meters at the IAAF World Challenge meet in Hengelo, Netherlands on Sunday. Eritrean Abrar Osman was runner-up ahead of Kenyan Bethwel Birgen. Kenya's World Youth Champion Willie Tarbay prevailed in 800 meters in 1 minute and 45.87 seconds. Ghana's Sean Safo Antwi was runner-up in 100 meters in 10.24 seconds, as Nigeria's Tosin Oke was second in triple jump courtesy of a wind-assisted leap of 16.87 meters. Ethiopia's Letsedent Gidey clocked 14 minutes and 58.44 seconds to win the women's 5,000 meters. Kenya's Irene Cheptai and Ugandan Stella Chesang were second and third, respectively, while Ethiopia's Besu Sado won women's 1500 meters in 4 minutes and 5.30 seconds. Elsewhere, South African Louis van Zyl triumphed in 400 meter hurdles in 48.67 seconds at the IAAF World Challenge meet in Ostrava, the Czech Republic. On the infield, Egyptian World Championship silver medalist Ihab Abdelrahman was runner up in javelin with an 84.85 meter effort. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
And thank you, Mark. Have a very good day. And that's it for this Tuesday, May 24th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very, very good day.
Savor the flavor of African music. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. Oh, never say you're never mine. Also join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.